Accession number 13206, Reel 4.
The poop remained above water, but its deck was awash at times. There seemed to be nothing in sight from our position for some time, until a couple of Lockheed Lightnings flew overhead, and shortly after, we saw a small craft approaching. It turned out to be a United States Coast Guard cutter, which came alongside. We passed Jimmy Wright over, and then scrambled over ourselves. As the Yankee cutter pulled away, the skipper of our LCT looked back at what was left of his ship, and said to his crew, "There goes the old girl. I knew something would happen to her. Just count up the digits." Her code number was still visible, LCT-760, or was it 670? In any case, it added up to 13. The Yanks took us further inshore, making the rounds of various Navy vessels, which I believe were American, until eventually we were directed to a vessel that was anchored some way off the beach. We went alongside, and Jimmy Wright was lifted aboard on a stretcher, and we followed up scrambling nets to find ourselves aboard the fighter director tender number 13. Jim was taken to the sick bay. The rest of us were directed to a mess deck where we lined up for breakfast. This was followed by some form of documentation and a chance to sort ourselves out. In addition to doing its directing job, the FDT served as a base for SE Rescue, and a Calshot-based SE Rescue launch was tied up alongside. It was due to be relieved about noon, and we were told we would return to Calshot with it. We said cheerio to Jimmy Wright as he was to remain in the sick bay. I think he had a broken collarbone, among other things, in addition to his burns. As the FDD was a Royal Navy vessel, we left the skipper and the crew of our LCT aboard it, I think. When we boarded the SE Rescue launch, we found that we were taking an injured Luftwaffe pilot back with us. He had ditched in a Focke-Wulf 190 during the morning and been picked up with back injuries. The run back to Calshot was uneventful, and we were directed to the sick bay on landing. After a check-up, we were told that we were staying in sick bay for the night. Of course, we only had what we stood up in, and the following morning the service police at the main gate guard room loaned us shaving tackle so that we could clean up before loading onto a vehicle that took us round to a holding unit somewhere a few miles away, located in the wood. They didn't want us, and we moved on to a holiday camp near Bognor, where we were kitted out, and after a day or so went on 7-day survivor's leave. On return, we moved back to Old Sarum to join a casualty replacement pool, where we were told we would wait for a unit to come through the hotel who needed replacements. During the subsequent weeks, I pestered anyone in authority in attempts to get back to 3207, but without success. Eventually I was posted to 420 Repair and Salvage Unit as they were coming through, and we crossed to Mulberry about the time of the Fatty Gap battle and the breakout from the beach, but that's another story. By this time 327 were back in England, being reformed for the Far East. I lost touch with Jimmy Wright and Mick Ryan. Jimmy recovered sufficiently to be posted back to Second Taff on some other rearm and refueling unit, I believe. Jock Cruikshanks I saw many years later. He stayed on in the RAF and had remustered to MT. Of the others in the LCT, I remember Sailor Wright, who was on 3209, and some others whose names I don't recall. We met up at Old Sarum to learn that one of them, having dived over the side and swam for it, was picked up on the other side of the convoy and was almost charged with desertion later on. I also had a letter some time later from a Mrs. Skegg, whose son had not survived, asking for details. I think he was also with 3209, and regretted that I could only advise her of the broadest details, not knowing him personally or where he was when the incident occurred. Obviously, I've always reckoned that every day since D-Day has been a bonus.
Now, you said that you returned to Norway and to Normandy in August 1944, at the time of the Falaise Gap. What unit did you go with then?
420 Repair and Salvage Unit.
RAF?
Royal Air Force.
Can you tell me about that story?
Yes. As its name implies, a repair and salvage unit repairs aeroplanes and salvages those which are crashed. they undertake major component changes in the field, a main plane change or a tail unit change or an engine change or something of that sort. And they were established to support two wings. Each wing would consist of perhaps three or four squadrons. And the wing, the two wings which 420 RSU supported in 84 group were 132 and 135. The thing I remember about 132 was that it had at least two squadrons of Norwegian Spitfires. Both these wings were Spitfire squadrons at the time I'm speaking of. And so that the a repair and salvage unit would have a repair element and a salvage element and a base element, and the base element would build up engines ready for engine changes, build up main planes for main plane changes, ready for the repair section to do the engine change or the main plane change. And the salvage element would pick up your own aeroplanes. Wherever they crashed, you went. You didn't work in an area, you went to pick up your own aeroplanes. And so that there would be a number of these salvage teams and repair teams attached to each of the two wings that we were supporting. And I joined I joined 420 and was put initially into the base element, because that's where a fellow had gone on compassionate leave when the unit was preparing to go over to Normandy, and he hadn't, he'd been given extended leave, so there was a vacancy which I was able to fill. And I spent a little time, you know, building up components and doing jobs like that. When the breakout came from the beach, we started moving. And although we would stop overnight, we went up the coast and we stopped one night in outside Abbeville, and then we went up a bit further and we stopped at Lille, and we stayed at Lille for about a week. And at that point, I was then posted into the salvage organisation. So from then onwards, I was going around with a team of, well, a sergeant in charge. A corporal driver would drive a Coles crane. Another corporal driver would drive a 60-foot Queen Mary. And our own truck was a 3-ton Thornycroft driven by the armourer. And the rest of the salvage team consisted of myself and one other airframe fitter and one general duties man. And the system was really that a crash would be reported, its map reference would be passed to the appropriate salvage unit, who would then send out an assessing officer to decide on whether it was going to be repairable or what category it was going to be in. And he would note what problems might be envisaged in picking the aeroplane up. Then a team would be nominated to go and pick it up, being briefed by the officer that had done the assessment, so you knew what route to use to avoid whatever might provide a problem. And the general idea really was that the armourer went out and made sure the guns were safe. The Coles crane would go out and lift the aeroplane, and the riggers would work to get the undercarriage down, so that if you had to move the aeroplane, you could do so. And dependent on what condition the aeroplane was in, I mean, if it was a real crash or a burnout, you just picked up the rubbish. But if it was only damaged to the extent that it could be repaired, then it had to be properly dismantled, loaded onto the Queen Mary and taken back to a collecting point, when it would then be moved on to the appropriate repair units, which at that time, of course, were still in England. They did, in fact, move over towards the end of 1944 into a factory outside Courtrai, I think. So our bent aeroplanes didn't go back to England, they were just moved back to this forward repair organisation.
Did you ever get any enemy attacks coming close to you?
Oh, of course, the classic was when on the morning of the 1st of January the Germans took advantage of the probability that there would be a lot of hangovers from the night before, and of course they caught a lot of the Air Force on the ground. The people that were really airborne at the time were the Poles, and they were fairly successful. They were coming back from a sweep, I think. But there was a fair amount of damage done to aircraft on the ground, so that gave us a lot of trade for the next week or two, picking up and transporting damaged aeroplanes.
Were you strafed or bombed on the 1st of January 45?
Yes, I was at the Bergen-op-Zoom just outside of Antwerp.
Can you describe what happened?
Well, it's all much the same as one would expect, really. We didn't know what was going to happen. There was no warning given. We just heard a lot of noise and you just dived for a slit trench. And when it was all over, you then started to sort out the rubbish.
How much damage was done at Bergen-op-Zoom?
Well, I think that comparatively light, there were one or two aeroplanes that were damaged, and I believe that it was with the other wing, which was across at a place called Maldigham, where there was an incident I heard of. I didn't see this because I wasn't there, but I was told afterwards that they did get some aircraft off, and when they landed to rearm and refuel, I think there must have been a combination of things which brought about the incident. A Bowser was positioned in front of a Spitfire to refuel it, and I'd always thought that the fire and safe button on the control column would always be at safe when the aeroplane was on the deck, but apparently the pilot in getting out must have pressed the button and fired off a few rounds straight into the Bowser, which of course went up in flames.
Any other incidents that happened to you in Northwest Europe in 44-45?
Well, another one that comes to mind, of course, was that I was around Brussels at the time of Arnhem, and I suppose it would have been after Christmas in the early part of 1945. And things were getting... we were all preparing then for the Rhine crossing. We were sent to pick up a crashed Spitfire outside Arnhem in a field alongside the river. And in the field was a brick kiln that was being used by the Canadians as an artillery observation point, watching Jerry across the river. And to get into this field, we had to go over a raised dike. So the idea was that when it got dark, we went in on foot to have a look at it, but in daylight. But as soon as it got dark, when we felt it safe to take the crane over the top of this dike, which of course was under observation, we took the crane in and picked the Spitfire up and carried it on the crane to a point where it was hidden by the brick kiln, so that we could work on it in daylight and dismantle it. And that took a day or so. And then the idea was that as soon as it got dark, the Queen Mary would be taken over to into the field, and the crane would then lift the major fuselage, and then the main planes were stacked on either side, ready to get it out. When we were ready to go, these Canadian artillery men decided that they would call up a priest, which was a self-propelled gun, to keep Jerry's head down while we were getting this aeroplane over the dike. And they got this priest in position just as we were sort of ready to start to move. And Jerry didn't really like the idea of this priest shelling him, so he started to throw it back with mortars. So just as we got out of the hidden position behind the kiln and approaching the point where we'd have to go up and over the top of the ramp, that's when we started to get mortared, but nobody was hurt, and we got the aeroplane out without any damage. The priest left in the middle. They said it was too hot for them.
Did you go into Germany yourself?
Yes. Over the Rhine at Wesel, and a few times from a base that we were working from outside of Eindhoven, a place called Skindles. And when the Rhine crossing came, then obviously aircraft were crashing on the far side of the river, it was necessary for us to go over, pick them up and bring them back. And then eventually, when the war finished, literally we'd gone into Germany and come back into Holland, and I was at a place called 20 outside the town of Essen, Enschede, when on the night of VE Day. And the parent unit itself, with the other half, as it were at an old Luftwaffe airfield outside Oldenburg called Quackenbrook. So that really I finished the war, having been into Germany, I was really geographically back in Holland.
What happened on VE Day at Enschede?
I was on guard. Everybody else was having a party and I was busy making sure the people didn't get hurt, I suppose, because you know, we weren't quite sure how many ex-Wehrmacht or whatever might still be around the area. And I can remember we spent part of the day getting anything that was combustible into an old anti-aircraft pit. Enschede was an airfield that had been used by the 20 had been used by the Luftwaffe, and it got its own anti-aircraft positions, which had got no guns in by the time we got there. But we filled this gun pit up with just about everything that was combustible, old bits of buildings, doors, windows, anything that we could find that might burn. And they found some fuel of some sort. I can't remember now what it was. And as I say, I was on guard that night. They set fire to this lot and had a wonderful bonfire. And the senior NCOs who were there had got access to rum. And two or three of them were going round and round the outside of this gun pit doing a sort of an Indian war dance, having taken advantage of the emergency issue of rum. We went down into Enschede the day after. The people, of course, were dancing in the streets and things of that sort.
What kind of reception did you get from the Dutch on liberation?
Oh, they were obviously completely exhilarated by it all. I mean, we'd met them during the winter of 44-45 in going to pick up aeroplanes, because the idea really was, although you were supplied with a tent, which was alright in the summer, in the winter months obviously the friendly locals would insist on billeting you somewhere or another, not necessarily in their homes, but in a village hall or anywhere like that. But they would, if they took you into their homes, they would provide you with a meal off of their meagre rations, or we would supplement what they'd got with what we were carrying, because we always carried rations with us.
Was that the same with the other nationalities that you came across?
Sort of chronologically, when talking about the stay in France, the time I spent in France, and particularly at Lille, I met a family there with whom I'm still in contact, just on a Christmas card basis. But they gave us a wonderful time. There were three families. We met when we were on this airfield outside of Lille. We were doing a main plane change on a Spitfire that had been damaged. And the only time that you could get people to clear away from the aeroplanes is when the engine started up, because they thought they were going to fly. But any aeroplane that was not obviously going to fly, the crowds of French people would gather around and we would pack up and walk away for a smoke. And we were approached by a young lady in her 20s and a young fellow of about the same age, both of whom could speak a little English. And they invited us to spend an evening with them. And we arranged that we would meet in a square near a church that we could see on the opposite side of the airfield. And they would meet us there, and we were going to meet them there at 6 o'clock, on the assumption that we wouldn't be working that evening. And of course we walked across to this church, to the square, and there was a gendarme standing there, and there was nobody else, no sign of this couple. and there were three of us. Taffy Browning could speak a bit of French, so he approached this gendarme and explained that we were waiting for people there. And then we realised, of course, that there had been a change in time. There was a difference between continental time and British summer time, or whatever it was, you see. So that we were an hour late. The folks had been there an hour before and had gone away. Of course, they thought we hadn't turned up. But then they decided they would come back an hour later to see if we had turned up. And that's just what had happened. This change of time had meant that we hadn't got together at the right time. Anyway, they took us home in what was an old Austin, what had been a First World War Austin ambulance that they were still using, only because they got a gas bag on the top of it. And we then met the third family. The young lady and the young man were engaged. The young lady's parents had a market garden, and her father, his best friend from the First World War, was the local wine merchant, and the young man, his family, was the local butcher. So between them they had been able to make quite sure. They gave us a very pleasant evening, and in fact, to cut a long story short, when the war was over and we were allowed to take local leave, we couldn't come back to England, but we could take leave on the continent. We came back down to Lille and spent 3 or 4 days with them. In the meantime, I must admit, I hadn't been writing letters, but I'd left my home address. And they wrote to my mother and said, "What's happened to him? He hasn't been writing to us." So, of course, the letter was forwarded by my mother to me, and I got in touch with them during that winter, you know, the winter of 44-45, so that when the war finished and we took this local leave, I went back down to see them. But I haven't seen them since.
And the Belgians?
Yes. Again, when we were outside Brussels, we spent the winter outside Brussels, initially under canvas, but then the mayor of one of the local villages came up to see our commanding officer and said, "You can't have these men in tents. There's room down in the village." So we were accommodated in houses with the local families, who were only expected to provide us with a bed. They weren't expected to provide us with meals or anything. And there was an area which the Germans had used. It wasn't a barracks, but it was a workshop, I think, which we took over as our workshops, and part of it was used as a cookhouse. So you'd come tumbling out of bed in the mornings in your civvy billets, have a wash and shave, and there would be a tram coming through, and you used to get on board the tram, and after a few days of this you'd get friendly with the driver and offer him a cigarette, and he'd let you drive the tram up to the other end of the village where you'd get off and have your breakfast.
Where is this?
This was let me try and think now. I must get this right. The street was Achterstraat, Grimbergen. The airfield was Grimbergen.
So all three nationalities were friendly?
Yes. I don't think there was any... I can't think of any occasion where there's any sort of confrontation at all.
Just going back to one or two things that you said earlier, you saw the loss of the eagle. Can you describe that again?
Well, we were in convoy, and obviously when you're flying aircraft off, the carrier has to steam into wind, so that if the convoy is going there and the wind is coming here, you can't remain in your position in the convoy, because you can't, you know, you're not into wind. So they then have to either turn the convoy or detach an escort and allow the carrier to take up a line where the wind is over the flight deck. So we actually, when we were preparing to fly off, had to move around in the convoy and our position was roughly where I think Eagle would have been had we not changed over. And we'd started to fly, and there's a lot of activity going on at the time, and someone must have been just looking round, I suppose, and saw that Eagle had started to develop a list and there was smoke pouring out and so on.
And the other thing is, when you were hit in the LCT,
yeah,
on D-Day,
yeah,
what makes you think it was a surface torpedo rather than a submarine?
Someone saw it.
Did anybody see the vessel?
Well, I'm only just going on hearsay, but we were told somebody in the crew had seen it. Somebody saw the torpedo track. They fired a few rounds off, which suggests that somebody had seen something to fire at, from which it was concluded it was some type of E-boat on our boat.
And you set sail from Southampton, did you?
Gosport.
Yeah.
People are surprised by this. An LCT is a very shallow draft vessel, and to set a torpedo shallow enough to ensure that it didn't go underneath it. You know, one claim about an LCT was you wouldn't be expected to get torpedoed because of it being shallow draft.